Hello and welcome back to Josh and Kyle's External Dialogue, the spin-off sub-series, whatever you want to call it, of Kyle's Internal Monologue. So we're going to be covering the Babylon 5 episode Infection, a often maligned episode in the fandom. So I want to start off with that. This is considered one of the worst episodes. It's not the worst episode, that comes much later. And I have my own personal hated episode that is different than the consensus. So, and that also comes later. So, you seem to really enjoy this episode.
I did.
What about it attracted you? And do you think that its reputation is warranted? And how do you want to fight against that if you don't agree?
You did warn me ahead of time that this is one of the infamous ones. And I was like intrigued. I was like, okay, this early on. I mean, from what the synopsis sounds intriguing. And I came out of it really liking it, but I can kind of see why it's not for everyone's taste. I'm a bit shocked that it's one of the hated ones, but I can tell why it's not a particular favorite. I think it's a bit different to what the other episodes are doing. I don't think the whole action vibe it's going for is really what Babylon 5's trying to strive for, so I can get why the fandom might not deeply love it. But even then, I think there's some real meat to this episode that elevates it beyond just pure mediocrity. I think the problem might lie in the first half, because upon rewatch, I found myself bored for the first half or so. But the second half was really great stuff, like not just from an action standpoint, but just from a ideological debate standpoint. The final scene is really beautiful with Sinclair giving that little monologue. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the fandom may hate me only a few episodes of this podcast, but I'm going to defend this one. I think it deserves a bit more credit.
I don't hate it myself, but I don't love it either. I follow it very much in the meh category, personally.
I mean, who knows? Maybe by the end of the season, I'll revisit everything. I'll be like, okay, yeah, maybe that is meh in hindsight. But I dig it for the moment.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is that it was the... And this is one of my questions, is that basically this was the first episode filmed after the gathering, so they had the 1 year break. Because of that, there's a lot of stiltedness, not everybody is feeling very comfortable. So does that affect the way you view this episode by any chance?
I didn't notice a problem per se of the acting. I think the problem production-wise more so of the editing. I feel like the editing is really rough here, more so compared to the other ones. Like the editing in the other episodes isn't amazing, but it's passable. But here, I feel like there's a more noticeable abrupt cut. Not everything flows well as it should. Some stuff feels kind of padded out and reused. So maybe that needed another edit just to really make things kick into gear. But yeah, it doesn't surprise me too much that this is the first thing that was filmed. It does surprise me why, though, because it must have been quite hefty for the budget, because the suit of the Guardian, however you call it, is incredible. It's so cool. I think I'm more drawn to this episode because I'm a big sucker for body horror and sci-fi. Yeah. I love stuff like The Thing or when Star Trek did it. So it was quite a pleasant surprise to find out that Babylon 5 dipped its toes into the body horror genre and gave it a cool kind of action, sci-fi action vibe. And yeah, the suit is just fantastic. Like, how on earth did they get such a massive thing inside a studio? There's a real Ice Warriors kind of meets Blue Beetle vibe going on with it.
Yeah. I got that feel when I first watched it too. I was like, wait, what is that Scarab?
Yeah. I think the biggest problem to design might be from a coloring standpoint. Like, it's very drab, very grey, and which isn't bad in itself. It's just that everything around it, you know, in the slum areas of the ship, it's very drab. It's got that grey metallic vibe. So I don't know, maybe they should have given it a brighter colour or vice versa, just to make it kind of stand out more. Maybe that could have benefited. But for what it is, it's still super cool stuff.
I am not as familiar with production and stuff as you, obviously, because you have the degree in film. But even I was impressed by it. B5 has this weird thing where it's notoriously low budget. It's more equivalent to classic Doctor Who than it is to, say, Star Trek in terms of its budget. But it manages to do stuff that you're just like, how? How? And you're just impressed by it. I don't know, maybe JMS is just like that good of a producer. He did manage to bring this in under budget every year for 5 years, which is pretty damn impressive. Talking about the body horror aspect of it, I'm not the biggest fan of the Alien franchise, but it did feel like the second film, Aliens, with where it's a bit more action, but it's still got that horror vibe to it. And you mentioned The Thing. What about that? That genre and that style and how B5 did it draws you to it.
It works well with the first half setup, like Franklin's old buddy, his old professor, Vance Hendricks, pops up. He's a space archaeologist. He's like, "Hi, I found this thing. I need your help to discover it." So that's a nice setup. It really goes into ancient civilizations, which isn't. It should be used more in science fiction, I feel. Because there's so much mystery you can do with such a subject, like how powerful were these ancient beings? Why did they vanish off the map? What happened to them? So it's nice that you can have like the repercussions of their technology show up all these years later and in a completely different area of the universe, and just see how it will fuck up a guy's life. one bad day at the office, if you will. I feel like it didn't need to be an action kind of story. I feel like it could have been more slow build. I think if they built up Nelson a bit more as a sympathetic or more layered character, you could have done something a bit more slow paced, a bit more twisted with it, make it more personalized. But as is, Nelson is a very one trick kind of pony. You know, we see him kill a guy in the get go, we find out that he's working for the doctor, and then he doesn't really have much character after that. Yeah. He gets possessed. I think they say he's alive after the nanotech is taken out of him, the biotech. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't made very clear, so he's not really much of a character you're rooting for the episode. Mm.
Interestingly, the actor will return as a different character, and that character is a sweetheart, and you love him. It's just really funny to see he's playing the stereotypical bad guy, and then the next time you see him, he's just like, "Aw." Well, kind of. In that first time that Talon shows up, you don't quite understand him. But the next time, you're like, "Aw, he's a sweetheart."
Yeah, it's nice. Maybe they could have flipped it so that it's Vance Hendricks who got infected, because that way, you know, he's already got an inbuilt connection with Franklin. He's a guy who we've already established he's so dedicated to taking shortcuts, because, you know, he wants to skip all the paperwork. He's like, who has time to come up with a new idea? We've got to scavenge the universe and find this abandoned tech and repurpose it for ourselves. You know, we've got to, humanity's got to catch up with the big boys. We need living ships. That's a great idea. You could have furthered that, but like he disregards Franklin's advice. He tries to speed up the process and he gets infected with the machine. And that way, it's Franklin's old teacher who's going on a rampage. You know, there's a personal connection now, instead of this goon we know is a bad guy, and it was there for like 5 minutes, had like two lines prior. I don't know, maybe that little twist could have added a little tinkering, could have added a bit more depth to it.
I think that is worth pivoting, because I think what you said is actually very interesting. And would actually make for, I think, a more interesting story. I think it would be a lot more loved if it was that, if it was Vance, I think. Because, Vance gets some time. He's pretty interesting, I think, in terms of the way that he's compromising his wants and desires as an archaeologist, because he doesn't have the money.
Yeah.
And I think that's worth pivoting towards two aspects of this. First is IPX. Interplanetary expeditions. They're the only people willing to fund Vance and his stuff. We'll find out their slogan later, which basically endorses grave robbing, which we already, Franklin already pointed out.
Yeah.
And they are a megacorp, and they deal in bioweapons, and basically there's this entire aspect of humans abusing the past to create a future. And that's one of the themes of the episode, is you got to remember the past, blah, blah, blah. We'll get into that later. But IPX as a thing, basically archaeology as ultra-capitalism. What is your thoughts on that?
I dig it. The show is already set up as how corrupt things are back at Earth. So it makes sense. You add a name to one of these corporations that we're establishing them, because I'm sure they're going to be a much bigger threat later on. As the end of the episode implies, people back on Earth have got big plans for the bioweaponry. They come to the station to take it back. So that's going to be big problems for later, I'm betting. And yeah, every sci-fi story has got to have an anti-capitalism message. You just got to, especially in the 90s. It's like that line in Austin Powers. You want to conquer the world, but there is no world anymore. It's just corporations. Hilarious movie, but that line cuts deep.
Yeah, there's you'll probably long forget this because it'll be a long time before we get to it, but there's in the spin-off Crusade, there's a character who works for IPX. Cool. And when asked why he works for them, because they are known to be scoundrels, he's like, I'm an archaeologist. I deal in civilizations that have died long ago. But the great thing about corporations is that as everything turns to dust, they remain.
That's a solid line.
Mm-hmm. He's also the best character in that show, but we'll get there in due course. We got a long way to go before we get to Crusade. So, the other aspect is the organic tech. It's established that Vorlons have organic tech. It's rumored that Minbari have organic tech. The Akaran war machine was organic in nature. It had veins, it had capillaries, it had rods and cones. And so this idea that organic technology is the pinnacle of what technology can be, because as far as we know, the Vorlons are top dog. You can't touch them. So what's your take on that? Because a lot of things don't do organic technology, or if they do, it's often in a bizarre. The only really think of that really tried to tackle it was oddly Star Wars in the expanded universe, but it went the opposite direction. That organic technology was the precursor to hardline technology later on. So what's your thoughts on the way organic technology is used here?
I love it. I find it much more interesting than nanotechnology, which Hollywood is all about these days. Even James Bond did nanotechnology, which I found a really weird, you know, really weird way for that kind of franchise to use it. Like, you know, you don't associate that franchise with kind of, well, okay, they go to space, so there's a kind of sci-fi element to it occasionally. But even then, I found having nanotechnology just a weird turn. It's just, you know, especially with the Marvel films, it's a cheap shortcut. Like, you don't have physical masks anymore. You just have a CGI helmet that you can you can blip on and off with the, you know, swifting of a head. It's like the last Ant-Man movie. You can have a drinking game with every time they have the helmet on just to take it off a minute later with just a click of a finger, just dissolves around the head. So yeah, I find it cheap. I find biotech much more visually interesting because it's more, it doesn't feel cheap. There's like a limit to what it can do. It's not like a miracle cure or whatever, like nanotechnology. There's a limit to what it can do. Guardians of the Galaxy 3, of all places, did a really interesting thing with like organic tech in that film. They had the whole station that was made of, that was organically grown. You could just tell that how fleshy it is, how it's all connected, like the like veins and stuff. And it's cool. It definitely adds a very memorable impression. Even the suits that the guards are wearing are very like meat suits with jetpacks. It's great. It adds a cool visual. It shows just how powerful scientists in far corners of that galaxy can be. It makes sense that in this universe, it would be those races with such technology would be highly regarded as one of the top dogs, like the Minbari and the Vorlon. Would now be a good time to talk about my Vorlon theory, or shall we save that for the next time we see them pop up?
Go ahead. If you want to do your Vorlon theory, go ahead.
Alrighty. So last time we talked about them, I had the whole angel comparison. But now I think there's something a bit darker to them, because you mentioned in the past I've already met one of the shadows, so I just haven't known it yet. So what I'm thinking is, what if the Vorlon are the shadows? It'll be funny because we've seen them as pure energy beings underneath the suit. It would be a great joke that these beings of pure light are actually the shadows. Mm-hmm. What if they are these angels of death in a way? So that, again, I don't confirm or deny. That's just my take on it. I think you mentioned in the past, oh, why would these great beings suddenly show up to this ambassador station? Maybe to spy on them, maybe to get a better insight before the big invasion plans, or something like that. Yeah. Something along those lines.
It's an interesting theory. I do want to clarify my statement. It wasn't that you've met a shadow, that the shadows are already here, is what I said.
Right, that is already here.
Yeah, that's just a direct quote from an episode like okay. five episodes from now. So
jumping the gun, am I?
That was just a direct quote. But the shadow's influence will be a lot bigger once you understand what's going on. But you haven't met a shadow yet, but they're here. Gotcha. and they're okay. Doing stuff. So I just wanted to clarify what I said. But it's an interesting theory. A lot of interesting stuff to unpack later. Okay, some fun stuff. Okay, the Akaran War Machine is used to talk about eugenics, effectively.
Yes, that's fantastic. That's what we brought me to this episode.
And the last thing we covered together was The Witcher, and that Witcher also has a massive eugenics plot. So I just wanted your opinion. Why do you think people keep, writers in particular, keep coming back to the idea of eugenics and talking about it and the rationale behind it and how twisted it is? Why do you think we keep mining that?
Because apparently the neo-Nazis just aren't getting a message, so we just need to keep bonking them with the hammer with all these stories till they get it. But no, as tragic as it is, it's always going to be an important message to get across. And I think this episode, Witcher does a great job with it, but that spanned across several books. This one has this one episode to tackle it, and I think it does a really good job that they do it in an engaging way while still keeping people who just want an action story interested. Sinclair's going, hey, you've got the first rule about being a fanatic. If you're so obsessed with the enemy, you become the enemy. They talk about how do you define purity. Their mistake was that they got this all right religious cult or whatever involved, who has very strict ideas about purity, about what it means to be, themselves, their top dog. They fuck themselves over. The slightest deviation, you're too short, you're too fat, you're not one of us, you need to be slaughtered. And it's very X-Men Days of Future Past in that way, in that the humans created the Sentinels to kill the mutants, to enslave them, but then that ended up fucking them over because they had connections. Like Sinclair said, we're all alien to each other. So that kind of thinking will ultimately doom yourself. And I love how it's tackled here. I love how the War Machine is so dedicated to protect. It's going protect over and over, but it doesn't realize that it's protecting a dead world. And I just love how Sinclair destroys it, not physically, but verbally. It's very like the Seventh Doctor in Remembrance of the Daleks, where it's just that one black Dalek left. And he just talks it into killing itself. Like, you don't matter. You're the last of your kind. Your world is just ash circling a dead star. And it destroys itself. It has nothing to live for. It's gone to its logical end. You go down a path where you want to destroy everything that isn't like you. You want to kill the unlike. You destroy yourselves. And I like how both stories address that.
Yeah. I also like how in that idea of the we're all alien to one another, you can also look at it from a more scientific standpoint beyond just the metaphysical, the philosophical, that I'm part Russian, I'm part Irish, I'm part Scottish, I have all these different ethnicities and cultures within my body, it's coursing through my veins. I'm American, but I'm also all these other cultures that produced me. Like, pure race, an Aryan race, is inherently absurd because the human race has been around for so long that we are all a product of pretty much everything at that point. We are, there was an irony, there was like an alt-right guy who got a DNA test, and he was super bigoted against black people, and then he found out he was like 5% from African descent. And so, like, what does purity even mean anymore?
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's all bullshit.
So on the more character side, we find out a bit more about Franklin as a character.
Yeah, Yep, seems the guy's got a bit of an ego on him. Like, you know, not a massive ego, but it's implied that he wants to be one of the greats. He wants to be, he wants to be the next guy who finds the biggest cure. He wants the history books to remember him, and Henriksen taps into that. You know, he knows him well. He's playing with that ego to help get him join the project. So I don't, you know, Franklin's not a massive super ego guy, but there is an element there that wants to be recognized. And so that's nice to see that be played. So there's more to him than just the bland good doctor.
Yeah. A couple of things we find out is that he was a hitchhiker for many years. Mm-hmm. And that he has an interest in archaeology and xenobiology. And that, as you said, he has an ego, but he's also a workaholic. He was completely focused. He was hyper-focused on his research, but going on for 12 hours, and Vance had to actively get his attention. So what does this imply to you? How does this make you think of him as a character from his introduction, where he's this very charming guy, but also just a good doctor? What do you, and then his optimistic view of life as seen in the scene with Ivanova. So how does this affect things?
I guess he's a doctor of good bedside manners. He knows that if he puts on a charming air, he'll be more effective at his job. And if he's more effective at his job, then the more lives he can save, the more he can get to that massive cure. Mm-hmm. Doctors want to hold back death. And I think he's studying xenobiology to take that to the furthest he can go, but he's still got morals. He doesn't want to take the shortcuts like Henriksen. He doesn't want to steal. You know, Henriksen, he didn't create anything. He found it. He stole it. And that's a clear line that Francis doesn't want to cross.
We'll find out more about his hitchhiking days. And I think that may change some of your ideas on him. He's got a very him-focused episode coming up very soon. So.
Nice.
We'll have a lot more to talk about that. But I always just liked that he was a hitchhiker for a while. I think that's just like a fun little small bit of his backstory that's very, very different from... Because usually when you get like the doctors in Star Trek are always like the best in their class and blah, blah, blah. And their entire life is devoted to medicine. And Franklin was just like, I just took a few years off and just went and saw the galaxy. I just think that's something very endearing about him, I think.
Yeah, it's nice. Shall we tackle the interstellar news subplot? Because I think it leads into the great ending, and there's some funny stuff in the opening.
I was going to transition to talking about Sinclair on it, but we can talk about the ISN stuff first.
Well, they're kind of connected. He weaves into both subplots very nicely, and they both add different aspects of himself, which is cool.
So we talked about how Sinclair is very hands-on. And we talked about how he can morph into any situation. And how do you feel about JMS trying to tackle the trope of the TV sci-fi series where the captain does everything? Because actively, the characters question him on this.
Yeah.
And that this isn't normal. He personally fought the assassin in the Gathering. He personally led the Star Fury squadron in Midnight on the Fire Line. He personally dealt with the Soul Hunter and flew the Star Fury to correct the stuff last time. He personally dealt with the Londo situation last episode. He is personally involved in the stuff that he shouldn't be involved in. So what do you think about JMS actively tackling that trope?
I think it's good stuff. I think I like that Garibaldi's the voice piece of that line of thinking. Like, in the start of the episode, he's very joking about it to draw attention to it. Like, he's a hands-on guy. If you die, I can just take over the role. And there's that cute little King Lear reference, sharper than a serpent's tooth. But then as the story goes on, as actively fighting the war machine, he's like, whoa, are you crazy? You're going to piss it off? Don't go down there. And then at the end, they have that great scene of, hey, we need to talk. You've been doing this all year now. You can't do that. It's my job to protect you. I know the war has messed up some friends of mine. They find it easier to find something to die for than something to live for. And that's beautiful. I think just that one scene is all you needed to just get that information across. And Sinclair, he's not deflecting it. He's not like, you're talking rubbish. He's very mature about it. He's like, I should have an answer, but I don't. But thank you for talking to me about it. That's fantastic writing. That's fantastic character work.
How do you feel about the captain of the show, effectively, even though he's commander?
Yeah.
Being suicidal.
It works. It works post-PTSD, post-war. It works with the idea. The pilot was all about him being like, hey, my life doesn't matter. This station matters. This mission matters. I don't care if I die. We just use this key to keep this mission going. And that's pretty much a manifesto for everything he's been doing since. He's ready to throw himself head first if it means protecting the lives of the ambassadors. Because if one of the ambassador falls, then the mission will fall. And he needs the mission to succeed because it gives him his life purpose. Mm-hmm. And that's tragic, but it's in some ways noble, but it's sad. It's sad that he doesn't have more to life than that. And I wondered if they would have kept that element the same if they kept the love interest, his partner from the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe if she was still around, he'd be a bit more relaxed about things, because she confronted him on his giving up the fight in the pilot. So maybe if she was around, she could be the reassuring voice in his head. But yeah, she didn't make it past pilot, so maybe, and I know next episode he does get an old flame comes back. They say, oh, let's not do it this time, but they end up falling anyways. So yeah, I think that it's deliberate having that take place after this episode. I think that could be him taking that wake-up call to find a reason to live.
Yeah, he feels like he should have died at the line, and he doesn't have a purpose, and he's trying to find that purpose. That's one of his major things as an arc. So you've picked up nicely on that. But I think it's a very daring thing. You know, maybe I read Daredevil, so I'm used to very depressed main characters. But in a 90s TV series that's going against Star Trek, to have your main character go, oh yeah, I just want to die, I think was very daring of a choice. I don't know about you.
I dig it. Because a lot of stories have those kind of characters, like Mission Impossible, James Bond. You know, the super spies who throw themselves in anything, and there's the whole internet joke that, oh, these secret agencies only hire people with, like, death wishes, people who are, like, action-high junkies who get off of this crazy stuff. But I like that here, it actually addresses the issues, like, okay, here's why he's taking this action, here's why that's a bad thing, here's why he needs to change, here's why his best friend, Gary Baldi, is trying to drag him out of it. And yeah, it's good stuff. It's what it adds a nice little self of identity to it.
The final bit of character stuff before we get into the ISN stuff, we get a more hints about Garibaldi's checkered past. Mm-hmm. And outside of the brief scene with Ivanova where he sidelined the issue, didn't state outright, but very clearly was saying in other words what he was feeling, to Sinclair, he's very matter of fact. So the hints we've gotten of his past, the way you've read his character, and the way he's interacted with Ivanova and Sinclair in these two very serious moments, how is that affecting your view of him, and what do you think his checkered past is exactly?
So we know he was fired 5 times. I assume he doesn't do well with authority. Perhaps he spoke too many questions, because that seems to be a recurring theme in that. Sinclair made the comment that the last time he was interviewed, they were like, okay, say what you want to say, be honest. And when he actually was, he got essentially exiled. He got kicked off to a new job that was on the far rim, this crappy little job. So that seems to be a recurring thing where you're punished if you question the higher order. You know, if you have issues with the pecking order, then they're just going to kick you further down and you have to work your way up again. And the pilot made it clear that this is Gary Bolgi's last chance, that he's the only reason he's still there is that Sinclair's doing him a solid and keeping him on because he believes in him, that they the two can bond over their ideas that, okay, maybe this isn't the right way to do things. We do need to question these kind of things. So I don't know the full details, for I know he could have a very traumatic family history. Maybe your wife died, maybe a kid died. I don't know. I'm sure that'll be a twist reveal later on. But it's clear that it's a sore subject for him when he was talking to the interviewer, when she questioned him about it. He was offended. Like he was trying to be charming with her the whole time. He was putting up with rude questions. Like she clearly didn't want to speak to him. She just wanted to speak to Sinclair. And when she finally does speak to him, it's a very hard cutting question. And he's like, I'd rather eat my tonsils. I'd rather have my tonsils lying out. Fuck you. I'm out. And it's good. Mm-hmm. It shows that, okay, this guy's he's charming. He may be the class clown, but he's got a line. He doesn't want to put up with, he doesn't want you digging into his past. Mm. And he's out.
I think the most telling line about Garibaldi, because he does put up a mask of this funny guy, which we talked about before, is in that scene with Sinclair, he talks about how he was in the war, but he wasn't on the line personally, but he did his share. And he's like, a lot of people I knew came back. Some people called them heroes. I don't know, I've never been one. And I think that really shows who he is in that one moment, that just that one line, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just the way Jerry Doyle delivers it. I don't know. It's just, it's a very lovely line, I think, and really indicates who he is, which we'll get more of in a bit. So you really wanted to talk about the ice end stuff. I want the angle I plan to tackle it may be different from yours. So okay. We'll see. JMS, before he was a writer on He-Man and other children's cartoons, was a journalist. And he seems to hold this profession in contempt. So why do you think that is? And what's your view of that?
Gosh, you're right. I did not think of it from that angle. But yeah, it's a good point. A lot of writers start off with journalism. I know Dennis Neal.
Daniel Neal. Yeah, Daniel did Neal. That.
Like, I know he started off journalism. Terry Pratchett started off journalism. And yeah, you see some messed up stuff in that job that they translated beautifully into their writing. So with JMS, I don't know what he saw. Maybe he resented how the news got displayed in a very slanted way. Maybe he resented that and he wanted his story to tackle, okay, here's what's really like for soldiers and here's how the news is portraying them as heroes and how they're cutting out the truth or something like that. Again, I don't know his full backstory, so maybe that's worth me digging into at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very good comparison. I was thinking it more so from a meta studio point. Like the very first scene is about her saying, oh, we all took bets. Half our audience, half our readers thought Babylon 5 wouldn't make it past 2 minutes because of how much of a failure the other stations were. And I was thinking of this as a more dig at the studios, like, because you were saying in the past, we don't want another sci-fi show. Star Trek is the only sci-fi show. So I was thinking that could be a little kind of nod in the ribs, like, oh, the studio thinks we're going to fail past the pilot, so let's prove them wrong.
Yeah, that definitely is it. There's going to be a moment in season 4 where he directly just attacks the studios. It's not even like a meta thing. It's literally just like, fuck you. I made this work. Go jump on a horse, basically. So yeah, I definitely can see that, especially because if you dig into him pitching, it took him a while. He was pitching this back in the 80s, and he didn't get approved until 93, that there was a lot of issues. You know, some people thought, you know, this couldn't be done, this shouldn't be done, and he kept being told no. And so the fact that he got one chance, and the story behind how he got that one chance is very interesting. I highly recommend looking up that interview. But he broke his molar trying to pitch it at one point. And so he was, he had to put ice in and go, my name is Josh Shishinsky, this is my show. Just grit through the pain. Because he was that nervous, like this was his big break. And so I would not be surprised if that was an intentional meta nod. Definitely.
Yeah. And so yeah, that rather shrewd, annoying reporter woman's recurring element in the story. She's trying to get in the way, and Sinclair's like, hey, we've got a crisis going on right now, I need to tackle this. Susan shows up, she's like, you're too young to encounter that much pain. So it's both a warning and a threat at the same time, which is very Russian. So that's a nice touch.
I love how she backs her up and is counting the entire time. She's backing her up, just like, get the fuck out of here, or I gotta do something I don't want to do. Ivanova, before we really understand her, is hilarious. But once you understand her, all that takes on a new tragic element to it. So, you know, it's fun in those early moments where you get to see her be like that.
Yeah. So then the report kind of vanishes while the meat of the story with the bio weapons happening. But then she pops up for the final scene. And yeah, from what I've seen, from what little research I've done, it seems that the one positive thing that the larger fan base says about this episode is that final scene, which is great. I'd probably say this is my favorite scene. Again, I super loved Sinclair just destroying the bioweapon with words. So I say those two ties my favorite scenes. But I can definitely tell why people would love this final scene.
Yeah,
because it's just no flashing gimmicks. It's just two people talking. And it's just Sinclair pouring his heart out into why he believes in this project so much, into why our future should lie in the stars, because we need to preserve our culture. And it's like what I was saying earlier, it kind of connects into the Soul Hunter. There's all these different ideas about what it means to preserve life. Do you literally capture the soul in a bottle, or is it more so about keeping your history, your legacy intact? You can die, but you would have saved artists and poets from born thousands of years before you were born. So it's great stuff. I'm someone who passionately believes in preservation. I'm someone who's distraught at book burning and censorship. So I think it's great that the show tackled that in a really poignant way.
And the ending scene is definitely probably the most well-regarded bit of this episode. It's not my favorite scene. Like I said, my favorite scene is the frank and honest discussion about suicide that Garibaldi and Sinclair have. I've been in that conversation, so I don't know. Like it hits me in a different way, I guess. But the final speech ties into the main theme, and Ivanova, you know, signposts it with her direct quote of "Those who do not understand the past are doomed to repeat it." Do you agree with that philosophy?
To an extent, yeah. It's a pretty basic line that a lot of stories tackle. And, you know, seconds after she says it, the government shows up and they take it. And Franklin was just saying, oh, this is a preview of what's to come, of what Earth is up to with that pro-Earth movement. Mm-hmm. And then he's ultimately proven right seconds later. So, yeah, there's a tragical vibe there.
You mentioned the pro-Earth stuff, that Earth actually has hate groups targeting aliens. This is Yeah, this is a very stark contrast to Star Trek. So, you know, what's your thoughts on willing to tackle that kind of thing? You know, because we didn't see that a whole lot in the 90s.
I think it stands to reason with what we've been shown so far, that there's all these shades of grey. In the first episodes, we were shown that the Narn and the Sentai, they're very racist against each other and against other races. So it stands to reason that back home, the poor bastards left on what must be a decaying Earth at this point, that they resent the people with the top power out there. They resent the Minbari and the species who nearly destroyed them. They surrendered, but I assume there's still a lot of resentment left. You know, they don't want to shake hands and become friends. They want payback. They want the technology back. So yeah, I think that's a very mature take on this, on the science world, sci-fi world, and that it reflects real world, that this resentment of the unlike would sadly be a realistic thing.
We're going to be seeing a hate group in a handful of episodes, so I just wanted to get your early view on that and how that juxtaposes it to Star Trek, so yeah. And there's a very sadly realistic aspect of B5. So that was all my questions. I'm not the biggest fan of this episode, but clearly you loved it, and that's great. You have any questions for me?
Not a question, but just another little trivia dive. It's not like it's not as deep as the last couple ones we've done in the past. This one's a bit of a spoilery element to it, but I wouldn't say it's too massive. When Franklin is briefing Sinclair on what he found from the data devices, he says that the Icarans were invaded 7 times. According to Babylon 5 canon, the invaders were the Shadows. So I just think that's a nice little detail in establishing these guys early on, even though I, as a casual audience, wouldn't have recognized that at the moment. But yeah, yes. I think that's a nice touch, that we can already feel the ripple effects of the Shadows.
Yep.
That their attack on you know, kind of innocent civilization, caused them to go too far and ultimately fuck themselves over, and that would lead to them an aftermath of their own devices near destroying this station. So yeah, it's a nice little touch.
Yeah, the Shadows play on weakness, and they played on the Inkar and xenophobia. And so we'll come to understand them more as time goes on, and you'll understand why they do what they do, and what the hell's going on. You haven't even met one yet. That's actually not too far away. I knew that they had mentioned, I believe it's in one of the books where it's confirmed that it was the Shadows. So like it's a nice little bit of world building where you get the sense that this universe is far larger than what we're seeing, and we're just seeing a small glimpse of it. And I think that's really effective. You know, it makes it feel lived in.
Yeah. But yeah, in conclusion, I think it's a nice touch that if this is a really disregarded episode, that still has some really meaty elements to it, like all the themes and the strong scenes, like the suicide discussion and the final scene. If this is one of the bad episodes, then bloody hell, I'm in for a good time.
There's two episodes this season that are considered bad. One of them, I think, has a redeeming quality in it that I actually quite enjoy. My most hated episode's in season two, and the widely regarded worst episode is in season three. After that, some people take issue with the way season five is paced, but I don't personally. But outside of that, we have very few bad episodes. Even the worst episodes have redeeming stuff about them, in my opinion. Like I said, I don't love Infection, but I don't hate it either. It's just kind of meh to me. The highlight is the insight into Sinclair's survivor's guilt. So do you have anything else?
I'm all good. I'm all content. Once we're done with this recording this episode, I'm going to dive into a new batch of episodes, the next disc. And yeah,
good all right. Times ahead. You got a bunch of really good ones coming up. So nice. See you next time for Parliament of Dreams. Probably it's a fan favorite episode. I love it too. And because, well, when you wrap it in purple, it's stunning. See you then.
Nice. Goodbye.